Blog Talk Radio.
In the desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, on this Monday edition of The Cross in the Desert. I hope that you had an incredible weekend and you're ready for a new week, a new challenge, a new adventure this week. Well, I think the entire world is focused in that small, tiny country of Nepal, which is bordering China and India, where Mount Everest is. As in these last few days, we have been just horrified by the images of death and destruction. And every day I've worked this weekend, I've tried to keep up with the events there, and the death toll has just soared. And now I think it's almost 4,000 people whose lives were changed in just a matter of a few seconds, maybe a minute, with an 8.0 magnitude earthquake. And I want to bring us the latest information on what is happening there, but even after you get a report, a few hours later, there are either aftershocks or changes in the death toll. But this is the latest information I have from Fox News, and let's get a behind-the-scenes look at the tragedy in Nepal right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
We begin with the very latest on what's being called the most powerful earthquake to hit Nepal in more than 80 years. The death toll now rising to more than 2,500 people. Among the dead, three Americans. That's according to the State Department. We've learned that one of those is Google executive Dan Friedenberg, who was climbing Mount Everest at the time of the quake. Now tremors and aftershocks are hampering rescue efforts and the delivery of desperately needed supplies. Meanwhile, survivors are still in shock.
We were outside in a little place, and suddenly I heard a very big noise. I thought it was big birds. I was afraid. I didn't understand. It was my first time I got an earthquake. And my guide immediately said, "Come with me. It just protects us and pushes us on the ground." I really saved her life.
My father got injured. I lost my daughter. I broke my leg. It is very difficult now, and I have nothing with me.
As I stood talking on the road, suddenly there was an earthquake. There was a house in front of me which collapsed, and I got injured. I don't know how I survived.
David Piper joins us now with the very latest. Hello, David.
Hi, Shannon. Yes, rescue teams and aid are now pouring into Nepal, but it's becoming a race against time to get help to so many people affected by that earthquake. And there was a powerful aftershock felt today across the region, causing more avalanches on Mount Everest. A 6.7 magnitude tremor was centered only about 40 miles from Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, and caused panic amongst the survivors of Saturday's quake. People have been living on the streets because of the fear of aftershocks. Nepal is a popular tourist destination, and travelers have been trying to escape the country in the wake of the quake. The death toll from the original earthquake on Saturday could still rise. Some remote areas near the epicenter remain cut off because many roads are cracked or blocked because of landslides. The Nepalese authorities are also continuing to struggle to cope with the number of injured arriving at hospitals in the capital, Kathmandu. 17 people were also killed by avalanches on Mount Everest. The climbers' main base camp was hit hard. Helicopters have been transporting the injured down from the mountain.
We were able to establish connection with the people up on the mountain, and now everybody's down safe. Nobody's up on the mountain. Everybody's safe at ABC, but the weather doesn't seem to be getting any better, and the tremors keep coming here again and again.
The scale of the disaster has really overwhelmed the government of Nepal, and they have appealed for help from the international community. And many countries are helping, including the U.S. They've pledged money and also sent disaster relief teams. Back to you, Shannon.
All right, David Piper with the latest on the earthquake. We'll keep tracking it. Thank you, David.
The thing that is the most dangerous in any earthquake situation is not just the original destruction that happens so quickly, but it's the aftershocks that create more of a climate for destruction and death. And our thoughts and our hearts and our prayers go out to the many, many thousands of people suffering in Nepal during this horrible tragedy. And I hope and pray that much relief and rescue is able to get to these very difficult situations where people could be trapped under rubble and wreckage. And do you remember the story of the World Trade Center almost 14 years ago, when those two firefighters were down below the wreckage and rescued in a couple of days, and they managed to survive that horrific situation? I'm thinking there are as many people like the firefighters in the World Trade Center buried under the rubble that rescuers have yet to reach. So we need to just really pray for the people of Nepal, pray for the rescue workers to find those trapped under the rubble that are still alive. Our thoughts and our hearts and our prayers to these people that are suffering this traumatic, traumatic tragedy. Today on The Cross in the Desert, I want to change a little bit of the direction of what I normally do. And on The Cross in the Desert, I feature a lot of stories about the oppression that happens in Iran, in Afghanistan, Iraq, in many parts of the Middle East that are under the Islamic, radical Islamic control, from ISIS to the Islamic regime. Most every day I feature a specific story about the struggle for freedom. But today I thought I wanted to change directions and feature an author that has shaped my thinking, that has shaped my writing, and I'm speaking of C.S. Lewis. I don't know how many of you are aware of C.S. Lewis out there, how many of you have read his books or watched the current movies about his books. I'm speaking of The Chronicles of Narnia. But because not everyone knows about C.S. Lewis, it's always a joy and a privilege to share with you the man that has really influenced my writing and my Christian worldview. And if you have read C.S. Lewis, well, then you know who I speak of. He was a scholar, a master of the English language, a teacher at Oxford, a prolific author, and there are so many things we could say. But I want to introduce you to C.S. Lewis. I want to take you to a roundtable of just some authors and writers whose lives have been impacted by mine, by his, and I want you to hear their comments about who was C.S. Lewis right now on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
C.S. Lewis was one of the greatest writers and thinkers of the last century.
C.S. Lewis was a scholar in medieval and Renaissance European literature, and that was his regular job, and as his avocation, he wrote works in apologetics, Christian apologetics, dabbled in philosophy, and is probably best known for production of the fantasy series, The Chronicles of Narnia.
C.S. Lewis was a longtime lecturer at Magdalen College in Oxford, one of the colleges of Oxford University. And he's probably best known to most people in the English-speaking world, either from his books on apologetics, like Mere Christianity and Miracles, but also his children's books.
He was able to write in a way that not just people who are academics could understand him. Half the time, no one could understand academics. He wrote in a way that everyone could understand him. And in fact, I think that's what caused some people in his academic sphere to feel a bit envious, because Lewis wrote books that everyone read.
But he also tried really to think clearly about a wide variety of subjects, about his own Christian faith and how his Christian faith related to the modern world. And so he's very helpful with his imagination and his clarity in helping us really to live authentic Christian lives in the world that we actually encounter.
It's a rare individual that can be both an Oxford Don and a serious academic, but can also be a preacher and a popularizer and a writer of popular apologetic books and children's books. There really aren't a lot of people that can do that, and I think there's probably no greater elite populist in the 20th century than C.S. Lewis.
You could go on and on to say wonderful things about this incredible individual, but I want to give you just a short biography of C.S. Lewis and take us back to some of the key events and writings of his life. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to summarize on the Cross in the Desert some of his influential works and some of the key themes from those works and how it impacts us as Christians. If you've never heard of C.S. Lewis before or never read his works, the best thing I can tell you to do when you listen to this broadcast is to read his books, because I'm not going to do him justice by just quoting about him or even playing sound bites about him. The way you discover the mind and the passion of C.S. Lewis, you have to read his works, and they're very much available all over the world. But here is C.S. Lewis. He was a prolific Irish writer and scholar, best known for his Chronicles of Narnia fantasy series, as well as his pro-Christian texts. Born on November 29, 1898 in Belfast, Ireland, C.S. Lewis went on to teach at Oxford University and became a renowned apologist writer using logic and philosophy to support the tenets of his Christian faith. He is also known throughout the world as the author of the Chronicle of Narnia fantasy series, which have been adapted into various films for the big and the small screens. Author Clive Staple Lewis, or shorthand C.S. Lewis, was born in Belfast, Ireland on November 29, 1898, to Flora August Hamilton Lewis and Albert J. Lewis. As a toddler, Clive declared that his name was Jack, which is what he was called by family and friends henceforth. He was close to his older brother Warren, and the two spent much time together as children. Lewis was enraptured by fantastic animals and tales of gallantry, and hence the brothers created the imaginary land of Boxen, complete with an intricate history that served them for years. Lewis's mother died when he was 10, and he went on to receive his pre-college education at boarding schools and from a tutor. During World War I, he served with the British Army and was sent home after being wounded by shrapnel. He then chose to live as a surrogate son with a Janie Moore, the mother of a friend of Lewis's who was killed in the war. Lewis graduated from Oxford University with a focus on literature and classic philosophy, and in 1925 was awarded a fellowship teaching position at Magdalen College, which was part of the university. There, he also joined the group known as the Inklings, an informal collective group of writers and intellectuals who counted among them members Lewis's brother Warren Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. It was through conversations with group members that Lewis found himself re-embracing Christianity after having become disillusioned with the faith as a youth. He would go on to become renowned for his rich apologetic texts, where he explained his spiritual beliefs first via platforms of logic and philosophy. Now, when you hear these words about his short biography, you think about his meeting with J.R.R. Tolkien, the Lord of the Rings author. It was at that time Lewis had came back after the war. His real challenges to his early Christian faith were when his mother died. Lewis remembers praying the prayer of faith for his mother, and when God did not heal his mother, it put him into a deep, deep depression. And it was after he served in World War I that he became disillusioned with the Christian faith because of suffering and evil. But when he met up with the Inklings, which was a group of writers, including J.R.R. Tolkien, they were able to convince him through many things that Jesus is the Son of God and that Christianity is true. And it was during the 50s that Lewis began to publish the 7 books that would comprise the Chronicles of Narnia children's series, with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe being the first release. Now, the story focused on 4 siblings who, during wartime, walked through the magical world of Narnia, a land resplendent with mythical creatures and talking animals. Now, different parts of the Chronicles of Narnia series represented a variety of biblical themes. One prominent character is Aslan, who's Jesus Christ, the lion and ruler of Narnia. It's just an allegorical, wonderful series, and through his books, a lot of people were negative about his use of the mythical animals, and in fact, J.R.R. Tolkien was convinced that this book would just not be very successful. Well, he was very wrong. It's worldwide successful. It has impacted millions of children's lives all over the world. In 1954, Lewis joined the faculty of Cambridge University as a literature professor, and in 1956, he married an American English teacher, Joy Gresham, with whom he had been in correspondence. Lewis was full of joy during the years of their marriage, though Gresham died of cancer in 1960. Lewis grieved deeply for his wife and shared his thoughts in the book entitled A Grief Observed, using a specific pen name. In 1963, Lewis resigned from his Cambridge position after experiencing heart trouble. He died on November 22, 1963, ironically, the same day that President Kennedy was assassinated. Now, I know that just touches the surface of many, many good biographies on C.S. Lewis. One is in the film series, A Question of God. It's just very excellent, as C.S. Lewis is contrasted with the thought and influence of Sigmund Freud. It's something really worth your watching if you get the time. So how did C.S. Lewis shape the minds of many Christians? Well, through the Chronicles of Narnia, you think of them as just children's stories. But let me tell you what, they can touch the heart of adults. I'm one of those people. I saw The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in 2005. It was a beautifully well-done movie. Very accurate to the book, too. And it's the story of the 4 children who leave England to the countryside during the war to get away from all of the bombing. And they go into this elaborate mansion. And one of the young people, Lucy, the young girl, walks through the wardrobe and enters the magical world of Narnia. And the theme of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is sacrifice, because we see Aslan, the lion in Narnia, sacrificing his life for Edmund and all of the children. And so it's a beautiful book, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But one of the most influential books that C.S. Lewis wrote is entitled Mere Christianity. It's a good apologetics book. It's a good book defending the Christian faith. And in fact, the material that went into the book Mere Christianity was the result of many radio broadcasts that C.S. Lewis gave to England during the war. We sometimes think of Winston Churchill with all of those inspiring speeches, but also along with Winston Churchill was C.S. Lewis, who gave these specific talks on the radio to encourage the people of England during the bombing raids, and it became the book Mere Christianity. So let's learn a little bit more about that book right now, On the Cross in the Desert.
C.S. Lewis has become a phenomenally famous person. And I think sometimes people become so famous that it's quite difficult to get to grips with who the person is that's behind that famous name. And I'm really impressed that this script has got to grips with who those people are and given them to us, I think, in an extremely authentic way.
Mere Christianity was written 60 years ago and has been a bestseller ever since then. And there's a reason it's constantly on the bestseller list. It's because the truth of what he is saying, the truth of these weighty theological concepts being made available to common people, is eternal. But it started as a series of broadcast talks during a time when the world was in crisis.
I love the opening of the script. I love the idea of it sort of starting with the outbreak of war. I think that's a great place to start a story.
World War II is just breaking out, and the effect that has, not just on the government, not just on an institution like the BBC, but on very ordinary people.
Everybody was terrified that the invasion was imminent, that Hitler was about to come knocking at your door, and your life would change forever.
What's the point of taking these children in if all we can do is let them go to die? Explain it to me, Mr. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis was given the task by the BBC of explaining the faith, defending the faith, apologizing for the faith, really just to try and make the faith real.
The most important work we may ever do lies ahead of us. God grant us the skill and wisdom to do our best.
Sometimes you must speak out. Sometimes you have to say what you know to be true, even if it will cost you.
Young man, if I could win one soul for God by playing the tambourine with my toes, I'd do it.
My dear boy, that's precisely the thing that they think you're doing.
He believed he was duty-bound as a Christian to rise to the occasion and play his part. He was the man for his time to speak into a very secular nation about the faith.
There are not many people to whom that happens, and there are not many times in your life that that will happen. But in the end, that's the measure of the man that you are.
No one on the faculty will respect you nor give you any further advancements as long as you go on about your faith.
He wasn't just a motivational speaker who then went back and lived in a mansion and drove around in a big car. He was a very simple man.
He was honest. I mean, honest. That should be top of the list of Christian things. Truthful.
I never claimed to be an expert. In fact, just the opposite. I've said repeatedly that I'm merely a layman. Like them. You're one of them, Jack. You've become a voice for them.
I would like people to know that he was the gentlest, sweetest, funniest, kindest man to share a home with or to know.
I think the reason why this production is important is because it explains the legacy of C.S. Lewis. And it also gives you a sense of how lucky we are that out of this terrible turmoil of the Second World War came an amazing legacy that lives on till today and will live on beyond.
Those are just a few of the kind statements by people who knew him. And the book Mere Christianity was a powerful series of radio lectures. And once it was published in a book, it became a phenomenal bestseller because it was a good, basic explanation and defense of the Christian faith. And again, we can talk about Mere Christianity, but you really won't get into the world of C.S. Lewis until you read it yourself, and you won't be able to put it down. It's short. It's to the point, but it's a good explanation of the Christian faith. Now, one of the main arguments, and there's actually two, but one of the main arguments in this book is the moral argument for the existence of God. And basically, it's an argument that says there is a law within us all that tells us what is right and what is wrong, and that law has to presuppose that there is a lawgiver, and thus there is a God. Now, that's a very simple way to break it down, but this is one of the key passages in Mere Christianity. And what I want to do now is I want to feature two of the main themes in that book. The first is the moral argument, and let's listen to how that argument is stated by a group of scholars that comes from the book Mere Christianity. We're going to listen to it right now on the cross in the desert.
The moral argument is one of the most fascinating argument, and for me, I think it's the most compelling because we exist in a universe that has do's and don'ts. It has rules of behavior. There are things we are supposed to do and things that we are not supposed to do.
Every human being has this sense that we are truly and really, in reality, obligated to avoid evil and to do good. Everybody has that sense of conscience. There's this real sense within every human being that there is an ought, there is a moral imperative that comes from somewhere. And it is universal, and so if it's universal, it's not just culturally shaped, even though some morality, certainly we would acknowledge, has some cultural factors in it. But this universal ought, this universal imperative, has to point to something bigger than humanity.
Morality or moral properties have a very interesting feature, and this is they are normative. They tell us how we are supposed to behave, what we are supposed to do, and what we are not supposed to do. And if that is the case, if they are normative, if we have moral duties, not just moral values, things that we have to do, it really does cry out, in my view, for a moral lawgiver, if we do have moral duties.
I can go back to my days before I was a Christian and I lived a fairly wild life. Now, the idea that I didn't want God to exist was a very key issue in my life because I didn't want something to impose upon me. But there was a sense at one level that laws as such were just the imposition of society. They were the imposition of parents or schools or authorities or the police. And only suckers believed that. And yet, when someone did something wrong to me, I was betrayed in a relationship very badly, and I was deeply angry. In fact, I wanted to go and beat the people up that were involved in this because I wanted justice for the wrong that was done to me. So even in my non-believing state, that there was no God, there was no morality, there was a moral conscience badly orientated that I was following in some sense.
Another society may disagree with those very laws. What we say goes for our society might not go for other societies, and a much more recent contemporary example is, of course, what we saw in the Holocaust. We saw the most educated nation at its time come to a point where it was systematically exterminating those who they thought were weak. Now, why? We have to ask the question why. If we jump straight to the idea that they were depraved monsters, we're missing out on key information here. The conclusion here was that if we are just meant to survive, if that's our whole purpose, then we ought to make ourselves as strong as a society as possible. So we're going to weed out the weak. It's our moral imperative to weed out the weak. There is no way we can conclude the Holocaust was wrong if we are cultural relativists, if we believe morals come from our own culture or society. But we know, as we showed in the Nuremberg trials, we know what they did was wrong. And we're willing to say that.
Well, let me help flesh out all of those comments you just heard. Even the staunchest of atheists will champion themselves for human rights. And they will say that justice must come as a result of this evil done. But the atheist has a dilemma when they make pronouncements on justice, what is good, and what is evil. It's not a matter of just a cultural thing when I say something is good or evil. It's a matter of my conscience reacting to something that is bad. Well, something that is bad presupposes that there is something good. The concepts of good and evil originate not in some cultural thing, but in our heart, it originates to a moral lawgiver. How can we say something is good or evil if there is no God who sets the standards for good and evil? So there's the dilemma for the atheist who wants to be a champion for human rights and moral rights, because if there is no God in their view, then who can say what is good and who can say what is evil? You see the dilemma there for the atheist. So in the book Mere Christianity, one of the first starting points of the arguments for God's existence, Lewis talks about this law, this clue to what is right and wrong, which is nothing more than the moral argument. I love some of the quotes by C.S. Lewis that really, really helped me to see the way that he thought. One of them is just perfect. I want to share that with you. If the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found that it has no meaning. Just as if there were no light in the universe and therefore no creatures with eyes, we should never know it was dark. Dark would be without meaning. And of course, he's arguing for a moral universe with meaning. C.S. Lewis writes, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." Just an amazing, amazing thinking man. Now, there is another section in Mere Christianity, I believe chapter 3, where Lewis talks about Jesus. Now, you have three options, according to C.S. Lewis. Either Jesus is Lord, liar, or a lunatic, because he made some amazing claims. He was either a lunatic, a liar, or he's truly Lord. It's called the trilemma, but it comes from Mere Christianity. And I want to play an actual reading of that chapter so that it can flesh out the meaning to you. The next time someone approaches you with who Jesus is and just talks about him as a good man, a prophet, or a good teacher, think about what C.S. Lewis has written in Mere Christianity, and this will help you to give them an answer. We're going to listen to Mere Christianity, Lord, Liar, or Lunatic, right now on the cross in the desert.
Then comes the real shock. Among these Jews, there suddenly turns up a man who goes about talking as if he was God. He claims to forgive sins. He says he has always existed. He says he is coming to judge the world at the end of time. Now, let us get this clear. Among pantheists, like the Indians, anyone might say he was a part of God or one with God. There would be nothing very odd about it. But this man, since he was a Jew, could not mean that kind of God. God, in their language, meant the being outside the world who made it and was infinitely different from anything else. And when you have grasped that, you will see that what this man said was, quite simply, the most shocking thing that has ever been uttered by human lips. One part of the claim tends to slip past us unnoticed because we have heard it so often that we no longer see what it amounts to. I mean the claim to forgive sins, any sins. Now, unless the speaker is God, this is really so preposterous as to be comic. We can all understand how a man forgives offenses against himself. You tread on my toe and I forgive you. You steal my money and I forgive you. But what should we make of a man, himself unrobbed and untrodden on, who announced that he forgave you for treading on other men's toes and stealing other men's money? Asinine fatuity is the kindest description we should give of his conduct. And yet this is what Jesus did. He told people that their sins were forgiven and never waited to consult all the other people whom their sins had undoubtedly injured. He unhesitatingly behaved as if he was the party chiefly concerned, the person chiefly offended in all offenses. So this makes sense only if he really was the God whose laws are broken and whose love is wounded in every sin. In the mouth of any speaker who is not God, these words would imply what I can only regard as a silliness and conceit unrivaled by any other character in history. Yet, and this is the strange, significant thing, even his enemies, when they read the Gospels, do not usually get the impression of silliness and conceit. Still less do unprejudiced readers. Christ says that he is humble and meek, and we believe him, not noticing that if he were merely a man, humility and meekness are the very last characteristics we could attribute to some of his sayings. I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic, on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to.
C.S. Lewis, some of the most astounding sentences and words ever written in summing up the claims of Christ. Every time I hear this, I just sit here. And I don't know what to say because it's so well written, so well thought out, so well argued. A mere man who made these claims, if he was just a mere man, would be a liar and a lunatic, because a mere man cannot make these claims. I remember working in the hospital and hearing some of the stories of the nurses that worked in the wards with the mentally ill patients that would claim to be Napoleon, would claim to be God. But again, that's the claim of a mere man. This claim, if it was just the claim of a mere man, would be on the par of being a lunatic or a liar. But Jesus was not a mere man. He was God. And he made these claims that can only be substantiated if he's God, to forgive sin, to insist on worship. You notice that when people worshiped Christ, he didn't rebuke them from worshiping him. He didn't say, go away. He allowed and accepted worship. And when he forgave sins, he wasn't just forgiving sins committed against himself. He was forgiving sins committed against other people. This is something only, a prerogative only that God can do. And so when you read Mere Christianity and you come across the Lord liar and lunatic argument, it is a powerful argument for who Christ really is. And C.S. Lewis would have none of the patronizing comments that he's just a great moral teacher, because he did not leave that option open. And so, wow, when you read Mere Christianity, that is my favorite chapter in the whole book, Lord, Liar, or Lunatic. Well, again, we're getting a sense of the thinking of C.S. Lewis on apologetics and the defense of the Christian faith. But it is powerful children's stories that have really reached the hearts of many, many people. And I'm referring to the Chronicles of Narnia, the seven books that actually are being made into movies. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, Voyage of the Dawn Treader have all been made into films, and I think the next one is The Silver Chair, and I'm sure they're going to make The Last Battle. But these are amazing children's stories, but you may have never heard them or read them. What are they about? Well, let me help you. Before we hear this soundbite, I want to tell you about some of the themes and the symbols in The Chronicles of Narnia, and the book I'm talking about is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Critics have proposed that each of the seven novels in The Chronicles of Narnia addresses one of the seven deadly sins. Well, whether or not it's true, it is certainly the case that The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe especially focuses on gluttony. Now, one of the characters, Edmund's descent into the witch's service, begins during his frantic consumption of the magic Turkish delight. Since this is an enchanted Turkish delight, Edmund cannot be held accountable for his gluttony as if he were overindulging in ordinary candy. The real sin occurs when Edmund allows himself to fixate on the Turkish delight as if long after he leaves the witch. Edmund's consumption of the Turkish delight may also be a reference to the sin of Adam and Eve when they ate from the tree of knowledge. Adam and Eve also committed a sin of consumption, and God punishes them as well. Edmund's gluttony for the Turkish delight alludes to Adam and Eve's desire to eat the apple. So one of the seven deadly sins, gluttony, is kind of hinted at here in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Now, what are the other symbols we can see in C.S. Lewis's book? Well, the power of Satan. Edmund is a traitor, and his life is forfeit to the White Witch, just as any sinner's life is forfeited to Satan after death without the intervention of God. The White Witch may not be an exact representation of Satan. The imagery that surrounds her does not quite fit that of the devil himself. Perhaps he is a servant of Satan and is the overlord of Narnia, Narnia's special patron demon. The witch claims the lives of all Narnians who sin irrevocably as an allusion to Satan's claim of the souls of such sinner. So we see that imagery of Satan, imagery of evil, with that of the White Witch. Now, there are many, many symbols in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but of course, the main character, of course, is Aslan. In the allegory of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Aslan represents Christ. Aslan's death to save Edmund's life and his subsequent resurrection are clear references to the life of Christ. Lewis's novel makes some essential changes to the figure of Christ that makes Aslan more accessible to children. you know, and he's trying to bring Aslan down to their level, maybe a little bit different than what they hear in church, so they can, you know, relate to him. And I think Lewis's method worked well. He even received a lot of letters from children about the Chronicles of Narnia, about who Aslan represented, and he answered. And so we see Jesus in the line. The very shift from a man up to a lion is quite significant. Christ is a human being, which is, it's difficult for a child to understand all those concepts. But here we have C.S. Lewis in using the concept of the lion, which is biblical. Jesus is from the line of the tribe of Judah. So the beautiful figure of the lion is something that a child can emotionally attach itself to. It's kind of a romantic kind of relationship. It's a talking animal. It's a child's love and respect and magic. Very magical, but very, very big biblical. A wonderful movie, The Chronicles of Narnia, and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I want us to go behind the scenes right now, behind the magic of Narnia, to the director of that movie and his ideas in the film as we saw it. We're going to hear that right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
The C.S. Lewis books, The Chronicles of Narnia, they are the origins of a lot of fantasy. Between Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, they were sort of the forefathers of fantasy.
C.S. Lewis was a good friend of Tolkien, and you can imagine they discussed at great length the two worlds that they were exploring.
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it takes us into realms that we can only imagine. The challenge as a filmmaker is to live up to and exceed people's imaginations and really transport them to another time and another place. During World War II, the children are shipped off to the country.
Mrs. MacCready.
I'm afraid so.
And they go to stay in this household of this professor.
There will be no shouting or running, no sliding on the banisters, no touching of the historical artifacts.
And above all, there shall be no disturbing of the professor.
98.
The children are having a game of hide and seek.
100. Ready or not, here I come.
Lucy finds her way into this empty room in which stands this magnificent wardrobe. She goes to hide in it, and eventually she steps out into this wintry wonderland. She encounters this fawn, Mr. Tumnus, who takes her to tea, and then starts to uncover that there's more to this magical world than she realized. There are evils at play.
Eventually, all four kids walk into this magic world called Narnia.
Impossible.
Their whole world has been frozen for 100 years. There's a prophecy that four kings and queens will sit in the thrones of Kir Paravel, and these will be sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. They are meant to fulfill this prophecy. The White Witch wants to stop the fulfillment of that prophecy because that will be the end of her reign.
They meet a whole host of characters and creatures.
It's a perilous journey, and they meet this lion who is the leader of everything that is good.
Aslan is the original highest king of Narnia, and was actually the one responsible for creating the world of Narnia. He's been gone for a long time, but he's come back because he knows that the prophecy is about to be fulfilled. He and the children together can ultimately get rid of the evil in the land. It's an epic battle between good and evil.
This battle that we're going to shoot between Aslan, the lion, and the White Witch is going to be made up of thousands and thousands of creatures.
Over 60 races, 60 different cultures, 60 different species of creature.
From a visual level, it's 5,000 troops against 15,000 of the scariest creatures you've ever seen.
It is a spectacular movie, and you really have to experience this movie. It was so well produced and very true and faithful to the book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's something that you must see if you've never seen. It's a movie that can speak to every kind of person, and yet the sacrifice of Christ and the death of Christ for our sins is so powerful in this movie. And this concept of sacrifice is, I think, a beautiful concept. You know, even the Quran, the Muslims, when they speak about Ramadan and El Eid and the actual feast days that follow the Ramadan time of prayer and fasting, one of the concepts in the Quran is that we have the situation with Abraham and Ishmael. And Abraham is to make a sacrifice to Ishmael, to Allah, but he doesn't want to do that. It's a difficult situation, much like with Abraham and Isaac. And so Allah intervenes and provides a sacrifice so that Ishmael does not have to die. Well, and I think about the concept of sacrifice in the Quran, and all over the world during this feast day, they actually sacrifice animals. Why is that so difficult then with the concept of sacrifice in the Quran that many Muslims are offended when Christians talk about the sacrifice of Christ, that he died on the cross? To me, these are parallel images. We have it in the Quran and, of course, taught in the Bible. The imagery of sacrifice is there. And so why is it so difficult to believe that God would allow his son to die for our sins as a sacrifice to forgive us for all of our shame and guilt? I think that concept is very important, and it's very well portrayed in the movie The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when we see the lion killed by the witch and then rising again from the dead to give hope and forgiveness to Edmund and all of the characters in the book. A beautiful movie with many, many strong parallels. Perhaps the darkest days of C.S. Lewis's life was when his wife, Joy Davidson, died. And this is a beautiful love story. It was portrayed in the movie Shadowlands, a film that is very powerful in both black and white and color. It was played originally, I think, in the 50s and 60s, and then again by Anthony Hopkins in, I think, 1980, 85 or 86. But it's the story of C.S. Lewis's meeting with Joy Davidson, and this wonderful woman who loved his books, and she came to live with him, and he subsequently married her. And it's a story of her battle with health and all of the love and the suffering that goes on, and then she dies later on. But it is a wonderful love story. And C.S. Lewis wrote a book after Joy's death called A Grief Observed, as he's really pouring out his heart about suffering and evil in this book. But I want us to take time right now to go with C.S. Lewis in this amazing part of his life, because it's so beautiful, this love story. And I want us to hear about it. It's called A Grief Observed, right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
By the 1950s, C.S. Lewis had become a famous figure and the most popular spokesperson for Christianity in the English-speaking world. Living and working in Oxford for over 30 years, he was content and had no plans to change.
He was a bachelor leading a chaste life. There was no reason for him to think he would never be anything other than celibate. Warren was never anything other than celibate. And, of course, when Joy Davidman came along, kismet.
Joy Davidman was a writer, a novelist and a poet from New York. She grew up in a Jewish background, and she came across the writings of C.S. Lewis when she was an atheist and a Marxist, and started corresponding with Lewis.
She told Lewis in her letters that she had embraced the Christian faith in part because of his writing.
Lewis got lots of letters from eligible ladies wanting more than just advice about Christian problems. Why would Joy be any different? Well, she was different. She was different first because she was very, very smart. She knew Lewis's work. She was a poet herself. She was a novelist herself. And she was his match in what Owen Barfield called dialectical obstetrics.
Lewis married Helen Joy Davidman so that she would not be deported. But as they became closer and closer friends, they fell in love.
When two people who discover they are on the same secret road are of different sexes, the friendship which arises between them will very easily pass into erotic love.
At the time they were married, Joy and Lewis knew that she had bone cancer.
I am very shortly to be both a bridegroom and a widower.
Lewis turned to a former pupil who had become a priest, Peter Bide.
Peter Bide comes to the hospital, and Lewis asks if this man, who has some reputation for possessing a healing gift, would place his hands upon Joy and pray that she be healed. Peter Bide does this and lays his hand upon Lewis, who prays that he will get the pain that Joy is suffering, because the pain is ferocious. And of course, Joy is expected to die within a day or two. She doesn't. In fact, she starts to get better within a few months. X-rays show that her pelvis has grown back. The bone has regenerated. Doctors cannot explain this.
After her remission, Joy moved into the Lewis home with her two sons, David, 11, and Douglas, 13.
I never expected to have in my 60s that happiness that passed me by in my 20s. For those few years, Helen and I feasted on love.
Her great otherworldly ambition in life was to go to Greece. She'd wanted this since she was a young girl. They went to Mycenae, they went to Crete, they went to Rhodes. Joy climbed all the way up to the Acropolis. It was a wonderful bonus. And it was one of the happiest periods of Lewis's life.
But the cancer returned. Joy and C.S. Lewis were separated by death on July 14th, 1960.
Why did you make such trouble to force this creature out of its shell? If it's now doomed to crawl back, to be sucked back into it. Where is God?
What pitiable cant to say she will live forever in my memory. Live. That is exactly what she won't do. What's left? A corpse. A memory. A ghost. Three more ways of spelling the word dead.
A grief observed is Lewis's description of the journey he took after Joy's death. A portrait of grief and a struggle with his own faith.
Talk to me about the truth of religion, and I'll listen gladly. Talk to me about the duty of religion, and I'll listen submissively. But don't come talking to me about the consolation of religion, or I shall suspect that you don't understand. The conclusion is not, so there's no God after all. But, so this is what God is really like. The cosmic sadist, the spiteful imbecile.
He lashes out at God, and he says, how can you expect us to live this way? Very much like Job. Very honestly, he doesn't just argue. He emotes,
the whole of his being is there in front of God. It's a deep trust in God that allows him to give vent to his distrust.
From a rational point of view, what grounds has Helen's death given me for doubting all that I believe? Should it, for a sane man, make quite such a difference as this? No. And it wouldn't, for a man whose faith had been real faith. The case is too plain. If my house has collapsed at one blow, it is because it was a house of cards. Indeed, it's likely enough that what I shall call, if it happens, a restoration of faith, will turn out to be only one more house of cards. Something quite unexpected has happened. Came this morning early. Suddenly, at the very moment when so far I mourned Helen least, I remembered her best. Imagine a man in total darkness. He thinks he is in a cellar or a dungeon. Then there comes a sound. He thinks it might be a sound from far off. Waves or wind-blown trees or cattle half a mile away. And if so, it proves he's not in a cellar, but free, in the open air.
Some very, very painful moments for the brilliant scholar C.S. Lewis as Joy Davidson finally succumbs to a reoccurrence of the cancer. And those quotes you heard there are from the book A Grief Observed, which is an exploration into a man of great faith whose faith is shaken by the death of someone he loves so much. And you can think of the statements of Job in the book of Job, when at the end of it all, Job says, I know you can do all things. In other words, Job is recognizing God's sovereignty and his goodness, and he repents in dust and ashes for the things that he said about his character. And we can relate to this in every kind of tragedy that we've encountered or evil. It sometimes shakes our faith in the goodness of God, but in the end, we see it God's way because we understand that he had a purpose in the suffering and that he allowed it to happen for a reason. And usually that reason is to strengthen us and to change our character or to do some work in our heart and mind. But when you hear the story of C.S. Lewis, you cannot help but to see C.S. Lewis not only in his happiest moments, but in his darkest moments as he questions his Christian faith, which when we think of this book, A Grief Observed, we too can think of the things in our life that have happened, the tragedies and sufferings that have caused us to question our Christian faith and the goodness of God. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this short journey about who C.S. Lewis was and is. You really have to read his books to encounter his thinking, his passion, and his love for Jesus, and how he is taking some of the most difficult philosophical and theological concepts and broke them down as bread for us on the table so that we can understand them. We're talking about tragedy here in C.S. Lewis's life, and sometimes that tragedy looks like darkness all around us. I want to play for you a song that shines the light of Christ in the darkest of tragedies. This is something called Nightlight from the second chapter of Acts right now on the cross in the desert.
You've been there.
The second chapter of Acts, the song of hope, of light in the darkness of our tragedies, is called Night Light. This past Friday, April 24th, commemorated 100 years, the anniversary of when Turkish soldiers, over a three-year period, killed in a genocide 750,000 Assyrians. It was a dark, dark moment in history. Turkish soldiers and 10,000 Kurdish irregulars committed an act of genocide against Assyrians, Armenians, and Pontic Greece. In three short years, 750,000 Assyrians would be killed, 1.5 million Armenians, and 500,000 Greeks. This past Friday, April 24th, the Assyrian church all over the world paused with vigils, services, lectures, demonstrations, and personal reflections over this very dark time in history of the genocide of the Assyrian people. Naureen Anwea has been a guest on my program, The Cross in the Desert, talking about this same type of genocide that is happening again in Iraq with ISIS in the Iraqi government, with the systematic killing of men, women, and children, Assyrian Christians. This past weekend, my dear friend Naureen Anwea gave a powerful speech thinking back to this 100-year anniversary of this tragedy, and I want to feature this speech in entirety. It's about 12 minutes long, but it is something we need to listen to, because when we think of the horrible Jewish Holocaust of 6 million Jews, we need to also remember the Armenian Holocaust of over 1.5 million Armenians and 750,000 Assyrians that were systematically killed in 1915 to 1918 by the Turkish government. Let's listen to this powerful speech by Naureen Anwea right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Thank you, Doug. I would now like to welcome a woman who has made countless efforts to advocate for the rights of Assyrians and other minorities in Iraq, Syria, and other areas of the Middle East. She has appeared on a number of television shows and is a regular correspondent on Fox News with her host, Sean Hannity. She has traveled all the way from Detroit to be here with us tonight. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Naureen Anwea. Thank you so much, brothers and sisters in Chicago, who have invited me here for this amazing, beautiful anniversary of a bittersweet moment for all of our people then, 100 years ago, and today that we are still experiencing today. I want to start off by quoting a governor of the Ottoman Turks, what he said about Armenians and Assyrians. "We have made a clean sweep of the Armenians and the Assyrians." Those were the words of the governor in Ottoman Turkey, a leader in the nation of the Ottomans. O Turkey, how dare you deny a fact? I have a question for the global leaders. If you have a criminal who's committed a genocide against your family, your brothers and sisters, your mothers, your daughters, your sons, and your grandparents, and you have all of the evidence presented to you by the victims, why join them in their silence of remaining quiet and accepting it? Because that would make us as guilty as they are. Imagine one day a terrorist organization storming into your cities and taking all of your babies and slamming them against the walls, stabbing pregnant women in the abdomen, beheaded your fathers, crucified your brothers, starved hundreds of thousands of children who were hostages, and purged millions of innocent families onto their death route. This may seem like a horror film for the ones who didn't know about the details of the crimes, but this was a horrendous genocide our families faced 100 years ago which annihilated one out of five Assyrians that totaled a heart-wrenching 750,000 slaughtered innocent Assyrian Christians. Along with the Assyrians, 1.5 million Armenians, 950,000 Greeks, and also the forgotten ones, the 400,000 Yazidis, perished with us. They robbed us of all of our ancestral wealth and stole hundreds of Assyrian villages, grandfathers. One of my great grandfathers was so proud to be an Assyrian Christian that he wore a large gold cross, and one day they came for him and his ancestral land. Numerous Kurdish men held him hostage, tied him to a cross, and crucified him with the other invaders. They chased my other great-grandfather and stabbed him to death, while my pregnant great-grandmother was saved and escaped by miracle. Along the way of their escape, they saw the worst crimes being committed against the Assyrians. They witnessed the unthinkable, the unbelievable, things that people today can never imagine. They witnessed thousands of women being raped, killed right there on the roads in front of everyone. They witnessed the Turks swinging babies by their heads and their legs just so they can dismember them without wasting a bullet. They saw thousands of fathers who were forcefully tied together as the soldiers were executing as many as possible without wasting any of their ammunition sometimes. The victims who were held captive for longer periods of time were not only starved, but brutally tortured in the worst ways you can think of. The Turks would do some very nasty crimes. They would hold one piece of bread up high and tease them in front of hundreds of barely surviving Assyrians because of the extermination strategy of starvation they were implementing. Many of their rib cages were visible, and they appeared to be a skeletal system as they watched each other's families die a slow death. Can you imagine, as an American, watching your family suffer a slow death right there in front of you, and nobody was helping you? What did our families do to deserve this horrific torture that took place 100 years ago and is continuing today? The attempted extermination committed by Turkey is not acceptable, and it was definitely not acceptable then. We as the good people throughout the world must hold Turkey responsible, like Germany confessed to the 6 million Jewish people they slaughtered in the Holocaust. Why is Turkey not being held responsible like the Nazis were for their crimes? How is Turkey different than the Nazis? Why has Turkey still not accepted the crimes they committed against the 4 million innocent people? When can we give the innocent souls a right to rest in peace like they deserve from our God? Not only is Turkey responsible for the 750,000 Assyrian Christian civilians then, but the continuous and constant drastic drop in our population that has brought us to a near extinction today, as historians are saying globally. Please, do not just remember Assyrians in your history books. Remember us today They are doing this just today again. Our people are purged off of their ancestral lands and are scattered all over the world in our homeland of occupied Assyria, they're referred to as Iraq, are continuously invaded since you crippled us 100 years ago. And now, what are we dealing with? Another form of the Young Turks named ISIS, who are committing another horrendous genocide that our people in Iraq and Syria are trying to cry out with all of their voice through all of us and the administration, the current administration of our country, is failing to recognize, and they are dying until today. Turkey, Assyrians have roamed the earth longer than you've even existed. And we were one of the first people to believe in the Almighty God. We cradled civilization and introduced the basics of all technology to the world and even to you. We ask one thing, Turkey. We ask you to not just confess to the victims' descendants that are here and that are all over the world, but to our Almighty One God, and He's above all of us, that of the greatest mistake you have made of committing a genocide against our families. If you haven't realized it, we are labeled as God's right-hand people in our Assyrian identity, and Christian ancient faith will never die within Assyrians' children. God will bring Assyrians back on their indigenous lands, like He promised us in the Bible, through good people who exist today, who can hear and understand our case. It's best, Turkey, that you confess now, and we can all move on, like Germany did, as a responsible country, unlike your selfish denial for 100 years. We ask the international leaders and nations to please support us in our mission of demanding an internationally protected safe haven in our lands of the Nineveh Plains to be armed.
Those are the sobering words of Noreen Anweya, my guest who has been on my program twice now, a very powerful Assyrian Christian human rights activist, making the case for Turkey to admit, to confess to the genocide of her people 100 years ago that was celebrated this past Friday, April 24th. And then she went on to talk about how this same evil force is in Iraq in the form of ISIS, once again committing genocide against the Assyrian Christians. Very powerful, sobering words. A woman of great courage and great faith, making the case that our administration needs to do more to protect the Assyrian people, to create a safe haven in Iraq where they can live in peace instead of being exterminated and cleansed ethnically and through genocide. Well, my heart just breaks for these people in Assyria and people in Iraq and in Nepal today. So much human, horrible suffering that we witness with our eyes and ears. And it makes me think about what happened just a couple of weeks ago to 12 innocent Christians on a boat going to a place of refuge that were drowned by Muslims. I wonder if you remember this report. Well, my good friend Paymane Sabet sat down one day and decided to write a response to this horrible killing of Christians on this boat by Muslims. Usually Paymane is very direct with her words, and this is coming from her heart as she makes the case for the atrocities of this crime. In her own way of writing, in her own style, and she is really saying it like it is. So what I want to do in these closing minutes of my program today, I want to take some time to read from my friend Paymane, who lives in Malaysia. I want to say again that we are working together as we speak on her autobiography, if you will, her life story of when she once lived in Iran and migrated into Malaysia and became a refugee. And I'm very excited about this book. I will kind of be Peymanet's editor. I'm not doing the actual writing of the book. I'm just kind of working behind the scenes and making a few changes here or there to make her story stronger and more clearer. I will be her editor. But the name of our book together is going to be Stories from Exile, My Life as an Iranian Refugee. And by God's grace and his help, of course, we hope to have this book out toward the end of the year, in the late fall, October, November, and it's just going to be amazing. I'm so excited for my dear friend. But she wrote about this recent tragedy of the 12 Christians that were thrown overboard and drowned by these Muslims in a boat. I want you to hear it in her own words. What a messy world. It's really a mess in a mess after another mess. Nothing is in its place. All the countries with dissatisfied nations are Islamic. Still, they think other nations are not successful and blessed because they are not Muslims. All of the countries with bloodshed and violation of human rights belong to Muslims. Still, Muslims' motto is that, quote, Islam is the religion of peace and kindness. And we accept that poverty is not the result of Islamic rules in your countries. Insecurity is not the outcome of Islamic rule in your countries. Suffering in different aspects, bloodshed, suppressing women, abusing children, none of them are the results of the Islamic rules and Sharia law in your countries. Your countries are peaceful, full of love and kindness of Muslim brothers. Your countries are as safe as paradise. Wait a minute. So why do you flee from these countries of kindness and love and peace? Do you escape from Islamic rules, or do you want to Islamicize the world? If the latter is the case, why do you seek asylum and not migrate? You leave your Islamic countries and want to educate your children in an Islamic environment and fight with whatever and whoever stops you. How? You want to change their environment to an Islamic one because you want that and because you think you are right. You violate the human rights to achieve what you think are your rights. It's funny. They escape from their Muslim countries ruled by Muslims and seek asylum from Christians in Christian countries while they hate them. They are granted asylum by Christians and start to kill their hosts in their refuge because they hate them, because their religion taught them so. They find their Muslim countries unsafe and unwanted, and they get rid of those countries and waste the money of the hosts to make mosques and Islamic schools as if they wanted to change their new home to their old home from where they escaped. The sad thing is that they hate their helpers. They hate their helpers. Still, they ask them for help. They receive their warm, generous helping hands, and still they hate them. The sadder thing is that even before receiving their help, they show how they hate them and their fellows and still expect help from them. Maybe they believe that it's the world's duty to be at their service and at their God's service. The way 15 Muslim asylum seekers, including an underage brainwashed child, killed 12 Christian asylum seekers is very painful and confusing. How high their expectation is that they think the host country has to welcome them warmly, fulfill their needs, and grant them citizenship while they are a threat for the world, while they think everybody who does not become a Muslim does not deserve to live and must die. Can homeless people kill other homeless people when they are on the same boat and understand each other's situation? What makes them prior to others? Their heart or their cruelty in easily and simply killing people? They kill people easily like others kill mosquitoes. Really, what makes them think that they have to impose themselves to the world and the world have to accept the threat and accept them among their people? What makes them impose their religion to their hosts with the power of their warm and cold weapons? Do they seek asylum to save their own lives, or do they seek asylum to enter other countries to do their dangerous tasks freely and wipe the world clean from non-Muslims? If they flee to other Christian countries for asylum, why should Christians flee from these Muslims? to the Muslim countries to be killed by them or stay in their own countries waiting for them to be taken hostage or get ready to be the victims of a terrorist attack? Well, just what? Imagine what would happen if Christians drowned Muslims. There would be terrorist attacks in every corner of the world in revenge. When many people are killed in their offices of magazines like Charlie Hebdo, only because of a cartoon, which is an eye for an eye, Nigerian converted Muslims murder and behead a British soldier on a busy London street because he worked in Afghanistan. When that terrible story happens in Sydney and many Australians are taken as hostage by Muslims who were granted asylum by the host countries, wow. They even did not think of the feelings of the families of the ones they drowned. They did not try to imagine their own families in their own shoes, to imagine their mothers who said goodbye to them in tears, hoping once to see them safe again. If you believe that your God loved Christ so much that he did not let others crucify him, how come you are so cruel to kill the Christ lovers? They did not even think how important Christ is in their own holy book, Quran, that his name is mentioned much more than their own prophet's name. Instead, they followed the other contradictory verses that encourage murder and bloodshed in the name of religion and Allah. They are not seekers of comfort, happiness, and safety. They are seekers of death, death for refugees, death for homeless peoples, for hardworking people, for highly educated ones, for civilized people, death for their hosts, their helpers and supporters, death for children, for the voice of the oppressed ones, death for the non-Muslim world. In spite of the fact that there are always exceptions and nothing can be generalized in general, Christians do not kill Muslims or people of religions because they do not feel their God would ever be threatened or be put in danger by Muslims or others, because they trust in their God and his power, because they know Christ is the supreme power over all. Amen. That is my dear friend Paymane writing about the recent tragedy when the asylum-seeking Muslims drowned the 12 Christians and threw them off the boat. And she's putting it in her own words and saying it her own way. Why are they leaving their country if it's so peaceful, if it's so prosperous? Why are they fleeing the Muslim countries? And she makes her point in her latest article. Very well done, Paymane. Well, today we have taken a journey to Nepal and seen the suffering and the devastation. We've looked behind or over the shoulder of C.S. Lewis as he wrote those faith-inspiring books, Mere Christianity, The Chronicles of Narnia, and then A Grief Observed. And we've also traveled with Noreen and Wea in her speech about the genocide to Assyrians by the Turkish government 100 years ago, and now finally to this horrible tragedy. And what we say is this: God, you are good and you are merciful. And our hope and our trust in you is, in spite of all the evil and suffering, we know that one day you will wipe every tear away from our eyes, and there will be no death or suffering or pain or evil. We know one day we will rule and reign with Jesus for all eternity. And this is the hope of the Christian, that he will one day be in the presence of his Creator God, face to face, who will wipe every tear away from his eye. And he will make all of the evil disappear and all of the death disappear forever, because he is the God of good and he is the God of love and he is the God of hope that we put our trust and faith in. I hope today that you have been strengthened in your faith if you are facing tragedy. Thank you so much, Vito and Mary and everyone in the chat room, for joining me today on this very special program and a dedication to C.S. Lewis. I hope it's made a difference in your life. Thank you so much for spending your busy morning with me here on the cross in the desert. Please keep all of the people of Nepal in your prayers and your thoughts today as they deal with this horrific tragedy. Please keep the Assyrian people in your thoughts and prayers today as they look back on the genocide committed 100 years ago and yet today in Iraq. And once again, I say thank you and God bless you for coming to my program today. I will see you this Thursday again on the cross in the desert. Have a very good week and God bless you.
great.